It's Tuesday, the 21st of July, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from today's Wall Street Journal. IRS chief spied on colleagues when he worked at J.P. Morgan. Burnham becomes UK's seventh leader in decade. And Chinese AI models raise alarm in U.S. That first headline is by Alexander Saidi, IRS chief spied on colleagues when he worked at J.P. Morgan. Frank Bisignano, the head of the Internal Revenue Service and Social Security Administration, sits atop two government organizations that store vast reams of sensitive financial data about every taxpayer. More than a decade ago, he was co-chief operating officer at J.P. Morgan Chase, another perch that gave him visibility and authority over every part of a massive financial institution. At the bank, people familiar with the matter said he spied on fellow executives using his authority over the security department and position to access sensitive information and internal communications without an apparent business justification. The executive directed his security staff to use software to snoop in the email of rival executives, including Charlie Scharf, J.P. Morgan's then head of consumer banking, who's now the CEO of Wells Fargo, some of the people said. One executive said he suspected the spying and put a code phrase in his email, which he said Bisignano repeated back to him. Bisignano also accessed a draft complaint from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission about a questioned derivatives trade that was a confidential document only seen by a few members of the legal department, some said. He also directed his staff to use software to surveil the work of employees, sometimes seeking to track keystrokes, which can show draft versions of written material, others said. People said Bisignano's goal was to keep a tight rein on employees and use the information to undermine his rivals as he expanded his responsibilities. No allegations are known to pertain to the improper access of customer information. Around the end of 2012, following years of complaints about his behavior, including allegations of disrespectful conduct toward colleagues and underlings and of the breaking of company norms around data collection, Chief Executive Jamie Dimon lost trust in him and told Bisignano he would support him finding a job elsewhere, people familiar with the matter said. Bisignano left the bank to become CEO of First Data, which later merged with Fiserv, a payments company critical to the digital infrastructure used in card transactions and banking. Courtney Forrest, a lawyer for Bisignano, said in a statement that he never spied on coworkers. She said he never directed anyone to look through any employees' or executives' communications or engaged in any form of surveillance, she said. Bisignano never accessed a draft FERC complaint that he and Scharf have maintained a strong personal and professional relationship for years, and that it was false that an executive planted a code word to catch Bisignano reading the email. Forrest said Dimon never asked, encouraged, or suggested that Bisignano leave J.P. Morgan and that Bisignano voluntarily left to become CEO of First Data. She also said the claim that Mr. Bisignano's growing responsibilities at J.P. Morgan were accompanied by a pattern of undermining colleagues is patently untrue and inaccurate. After Bisignano left the bank, investigators from the legal department found digital traces of the spying activity, including records that showed email access, some of the people said. As a result, Matt Zams, who took over as J.P. Morgan's sole chief operating officer, increased restrictions on access to sensitive employee information, requiring approval from senior members of the legal department to access emails and other data, some of the people said. President Trump picked Bisignano to become a chief of the Social Security Administration, the government retirement system, and he was confirmed by the Senate last year. His responsibilities were expanded later in the year when he was appointed to the new position of CEO of the IRS, running its daily operations. Last Wednesday, the Treasury Department announced Bisignano would take charge of the implementation of Trump accounts, the tax-deferred retirement accounts for children. At SSA and IRS, his challenges include modernizing the systems that power the nation's biggest benefit agency and tax collection authority, both of which still rely on technology that's more than 20 years old. At the IRS, which has rotated through a half dozen leaders during the Trump administration, Bisignano is also tasked with enforcing the law with a smaller staff. Trump has complained that the IRS was weaponized against him by political enemies. In May, Bisignano agreed to settle a lawsuit Trump brought against the agency for the 2019 leak of his tax returns that included an unprecedented agreement that the government would never review or audit previous tax filings by Trump, his sons, or the Trump Organization, among other actions. On July 13th, Judge Kathleen Williams harshly criticized the agreement, in part because Bisignano is part of the Trump administration. The federal judge said the president and his family acted in bad faith, bringing the $10 billion lawsuit, and said it was brought to manipulate the judicial process. Her ruling doesn't alter the no-audit promise, but she said the acquiescence to it by Bisignano and others was wholly incompatible with their duties to enforce the law and protect the public interest. A White House spokeswoman said Bisignano is a trusted and talented member of the president's team who's doing an incredible job. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Bisignano's proven executive leadership has improved services at the IRS and cut waste. A spokesperson for SSA said Bisignano was transforming the agency to deliver world-class customer service. A J.P. Morgan spokesman said Bisignano is distinguished for his grit and determination that we applaud his service to our country both at the Social Security Administration and the IRS. Fix it, man. At J.P. Morgan and in his previous role at Citigroup, Bisignano had built a reputation as an administrator and fix-it man with a track record of turning around businesses. Many of his former staff followed him from J.P. Morgan to First Data and Fiserv, where he became CEO in 2020, and now to the IRS. At Fiserv, Bisignano helped grow sales of Clover, a point-of-sale payment terminal for credit card payments, and consistently delivered revenue and profit growth that made its stock more than double between the end of 2023 and the beginning of 2025. But months after he left to join the government and had sold nearly all of his Fiserv stock, the firm's new management threw out the forecasts Bisignano's team had been giving Wall Street and said they were materially inaccurate, blaming unrealistic growth projections, misleading revenue figures skewed by foreign currency fluctuations, and management decisions to defer investments. The move sent the stock into a tailspin and prompted shareholder lawsuits against Bisignano and Fiserv. Bisignano's attorney declined to comment on matters at Fiserv that are the subject of active litigation, but said the bulk of the decline in its share price occurred under the leadership of his successor as CEO, Mike Lyons. Bisignano said, "My experience is working for leaders such as Jamie Dimon, Sandy Weill, Tony Terracciano, Henry Kravis, and Scott Nuttall has prepared me for the privilege of serving the American people." The son of a customs officer at Port Newark, Brooklyn-raised Bisignano was a rising star at Citigroup and its predecessor firms in the 1980s and 90s. Dimon, who was a top executive there in those years, was impressed by Bisignano's operational abilities. After Dimon was fired from Citigroup in 1998 and later became CEO of Chicago-based Bank One, he tried and failed to hire Bisignano, people familiar with the matter said. In 2001, Bisignano's profile was raised when, as Citi's deputy head of technology and operations, he helped lead Citi's response to the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center, standing outside Citi's office a few blocks north and directing employees to safer locations. After Bank One and J.P. Morgan merged in 2004, Dimon attracted Bisignano to join with an executive job as chief administrative officer. Bisignano was tasked with tackling complex back-office problems as J.P. Morgan looked to integrate the multiple companies it had acquired in a short number of years. In 2011, Diamond named him head of the mortgage department, replacing Scharf after former Marine Captain Jonathan Rowles testified before Congress that J.P. Morgan had illegally foreclosed on his house while he was on active duty. Bisignano overhauled the mortgage staff, doubled the number of borrower assistance centers, and helped launch a coalition of companies committed to hiring veterans. He also spearheaded the bank's negotiations with the federal government and state attorneys general on mortgage-related lawsuits after the 2008 financial crisis. He was promoted to co-chief operating officer in 2012 alongside Zamis. They shared oversight of the compliance-related matters, which had largely been managed by the general counsel's office at J.P. Morgan before then. The two effectively split duties, with Bisignano focused more on security matters, while Zamis was working on financial risk management in the wake of the bank's $6 billion loss and regulatory scrutiny from the London Whale scandal. As Bisignano took on more responsibility, complaints about his management style and conduct toward other executives and employees grew. He frequently clashed with some top executives, including Gordon Smith, an executive in the Consumer Bank, and Todd Micklin, a commercial banker who was assigned to run some of the consumer business in 2011, according to people familiar with the matter. They and other executives felt that Bisignano was trying to undermine them in order to add to his own power in the bank, often disparaging their activities to Diamond without confronting them directly, some of the people said. Forrest, Bisignano's attorney, said J.P. Morgan's internal culture encouraged a direct, sometimes uncomfortable management style, and that Diamond said he wanted executives to ask hard questions. Bisignano demanded his own team pledge loyalty to him directly, people who spoke with him said. He told some of his employees he kept dossiers about them in case they went native, which they took as his way of describing someone who was no longer loyal to him, the people said. Around 2012, during a biennial employee survey review, which covered workplace issues such as how satisfied employees were with their jobs, Bisignano's division gave some of the most negative feedback in all of J.P. Morgan. Bisignano asked his direct reports to go into the survey submission tool and figure out which employees had written negative reviews, some of the people said. Forrest said Bisignano never maintained a dossier on employees and said it was false that he asked for negative survey responses to be traced back to their authors. Executives griped to Diamond about what they saw as Bisignano's use of company resources for his own benefit, including allegations Bisignano misused the corporate jet for personal purposes, people familiar with the matter said. Some also raised concerns to members of the legal department about preliminary efforts which didn't take place to use J.P. Morgan resources for the renovation of St. Patrick's Cathedral in Manhattan that began in 2011, people familiar with the matter said. Bisignano is one of the cathedral's trustees. A group at that time was responsible for raising funds for the historic $175 million renovation. Some complaints led to internal reviews, which concluded Bisignano hadn't violated the bank's rules, some of the people said. Forrest said it was false that he used the jet for personal purposes and that he didn't ask J.P. Morgan for money for the cathedral. Bisignano never misappropriated corporate funds at J.P. Morgan or anywhere else, she said. Around 2007, Bisignano asked senior executives to personally look into giving a loan to his friend, Bo Dietl, owner of a private security company and prominent New York personality with whom he often dined at the New York restaurant Rio's, people familiar with the matter said. The move was unusual in that Bisignano had directed executives to handle his friend's loan application instead of referring him to rank-and-file bankers. The bank didn't lend Dietl any money after reviewing his application, which upset Bisignano, the people said. Forrest said Bisignano knows nothing about any such loan. Deedle told the Wall Street Journal he didn't remember asking for the loan, but that Bisignano was a friend and the two did business together while he worked at J.P. Morgan, including when Deedle sold keystroke capture and encryption software to the bank. He said he also provided a group of former veterans to be guards for some of the bank's branches. Bisignano had good relationships with some executives at J.P. Morgan, including Asset and Wealth Management Chief Mary Erdos and former Chief Financial Officer Mike Cavanaugh, who respected his ambition and ability to get things done, people familiar with the matter said. Diamond, for years, dismissed the complaints as run-of-the-mill conflicts between ambitious executives, some of the people said. But by late 2012, he had lost trust in Bisignano after he continued to come into conflict with executives and didn't demonstrate a willingness to change, and he told Bisignano he would support him finding a job elsewhere, some of the people said. The chief executive has rarely fired executives who've fallen out of favor during his 20-year career. He has instead typically made clear to people they have no more room to be promoted and urged them to find new jobs. Diamond said in a memo to employees announcing Bisignano's departure in 2013 that he was a capable executive willing to take on the most complex challenges and get the job done. Sensitive Records. Months after Bisignano left for First Data, forensic investigations found digital footprints that showed Bisignano's staff had accessed sensitive corporate records and employee communications without a clear business purpose, according to people familiar with the matter. Around this time, Bisignano's key deputy handling cybersecurity issues and regulatory inquiries, Peter Caviccia, was pushed out, people familiar with the matter said. He joined Bisignano at First Data and currently is the chief technology officer at Fiserv. Federal regulations require banks to keep a broad range of communications, including emails, phone recordings, and instant messages, which can be used, if necessary, for compliance investigations. Regulators often inquire about internal controls on information and have penalized banks when they have found lapses. Bisignano, who, as co-COO, had shared oversight of security and compliance functions for J.P. Morgan, could access these records, and the company at the time didn't have strict rules requiring approval to access them. Forrest, the attorney, said Bisignano didn't personally access or have access to any individual records. She said he was unaware of the specifics of any forensic investigations and subsequent access control changes or the circumstances of Caviccia's departure. Investigators from the legal department found Bisignano accessed a draft complaint and inquiry from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission about an energy derivatives trade the bank had made, people familiar with the matter said. The confidential documents had been emailed to individuals in the legal department. The contents of the documents were reported by the New York Times in 2013, and some executives at J.P. Morgan said they believed they were leaked from someone inside the bank. J.P. Morgan that year agreed to pay $410 million to settle accusations by the regulator that it manipulated electricity markets without admitting wrongdoing. Forrest, in addition to denying Bisignano access to a FERC complaint, said he has never leaked anything to the press. J.P. Morgan didn't prepare a report documenting any investigation into Bisignano's alleged misconduct, some of the people said. When he left, the bank didn't grant Bisignano his unvested shares, people familiar with the matter said. At the 2013 wedding of Steve Black, a former J.P. Morgan executive, Diamond asked why other executives had waited so long to tell him their concerns about Bisignano's behavior, people who heard him said. Bisignano still keeps in contact with many current and former leaders at J.P. Morgan, including Diamond. In June, Bisignano traveled to the bank's New York headquarters for a farewell party for Vince LaPadula, a J.P. Morgan banker who has joined the IRS. The party was held at the Patriots Bar, a flag-filled watering hole at J.P. Morgan's new skyscraper, where Diamond had been hosting parties and social gatherings. Bisignano caught up with executives such as Erdos, but Diamond had left the party by the time Bisignano arrived, people familiar with the matter said. And that's IRS chief spied on colleagues when he worked at J.P. Morgan. Our next headline, Burnham becomes UK's seventh leader in decade, is by Max Colchester, London. Andy Burnham, the UK's seventh prime minister in a decade, arrived Monday at 10 Downing Street, pledging that a bigger, more muscular state can solve the country's economic woes and restore political stability. Standing in front of the Prime Minister's official residence, Burnham said he was acutely aware the UK had been cycling through leaders at an unprecedented rate. "It requires my generation of politicians to raise our game and rise to the new challenge," he said. "Britain needs to show the world that we can regain our stability once again." The 56-year-old painted a broad-brush vision for the country, where a more interventionist state would roll back what he called 40 years of neoliberalism. Burnham wants to devolve power from London to the regions. He pledged to present a 10-year plan for the country this year that would offer a new political model and a new economic model. Among the policies under consideration are rent controls and greater state subsidies for energy bills and bus fares, Burnham said. The UK government's 10-year borrowing costs rose to a 2-month high on the back of the announcements. Burnham on Monday officially succeeded former Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who earlier in the day handed in his resignation to King Charles III at Buckingham Palace. Labour lawmakers turned on Starmer after just 2 years in charge when Labour cratered in opinion polls. Despite winning a landslide in 2024, Labour trails Reform UK, an anti-immigration party. Burnham, a former mayor of Manchester, was named party leader last week after no other candidates stepped forward for the job. Labour lawmakers hope a new leader can unite fragmented left-wing voters ahead of the next general election, which must be called by 2029. But Burnham faces a fine line between appeasing left-wing Labour Party lawmakers and calming financial markets. Investors are betting Burnham's economic pitch will tilt the UK further left, with modest increases in government spending funded by higher taxes on wealth and more borrowing. However, his room to maneuver is constrained because the tax burden and government borrowing are near historic highs. Meanwhile, the economy is predicted to grow only 1% this year. Burnham reshuffled Starmer's cabinet. He named John Healey, the former defense secretary, as the UK Treasury chief. Healey previously quit Starmer's government, saying there wasn't enough funding for defense. Appointing the steady-handed centrist is aimed at reassuring investors who feared a more radical left-wing candidate would take the role. One area of investor attention is Burnham's stance regarding North Sea petroleum drilling. President Trump said over the weekend that Burnham would turn the UK from a poverty-stricken disaster to one of the richest countries in the world by allowing drilling for oil in the North Sea. The government must soon decide whether to greenlight drilling off the coast of Scotland in the Jackdaw gas field and the Rosebank oil field, where licenses were approved years ago but drilling was blocked by a court ruling in a suit brought by climate campaigners. The Labour Party banned exploration licenses for new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. On Monday, Burnham spoke to Trump and, according to a UK government statement, invited the president to visit Manchester. To strike a new political tone, Burnham paints himself as a working-class outsider from England's north who can shake up the government's status quo. The country's two establishment parties, the Conservatives and Labour, are shedding voters amid low economic growth, recent record levels of immigration, and a cost-of-living crisis that's fueling a sense of malaise among voters who feel that traditional politicians are unable to lift their fortunes. Born near Liverpool, Burnham entered politics in the 1990s after graduating from the University of Cambridge and went on to work under former Labour Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. He tried and failed twice to become leader of the party in 2010 and 2015. In 2017, he left Westminster to go to Manchester and spent 9 years as mayor, far from the increasingly dysfunctional national politics, overseeing a rare feel-good story. Britain's second-largest city was enjoying a turnaround after years of deindustrialization thanks to a more active local government and a rush of private investment. While Starmer floundered in the polls, Burnham agitated for change. He triggered a remarkably rapid coup after Labor performed poorly in local elections in May. Soon after, Burnham handily won a local legislative election and returned to Parliament. That opened the path for him to formally challenge Starmer, who read the writing on the wall and quit. "I want to be honest," Burnham said, speaking without notes. "We've not been good enough, and we will be." And that's Burnham becomes UK's seventh leader in decade. Next, we have Chinese AI models raise alarm in US. This is by Amrith Ramkumar and Tina Lee. Silicon Valley and Washington are debating a multi-billion dollar question. Should U.S. companies be able to use Chinese artificial intelligence models? OpenAI and Anthropic executives are sounding the alarm about the rise of cheap AI, particularly powerful new models produced in China, suggesting they will lead to a dystopian AI future and present unacceptable security risks without regulation. Some analysts who study the AI industry said the two companies, which are preparing for public listings in the next year, just want to eliminate the competition. The emergence of highly capable open autonomous AI systems, including Moonshot's AI Kimi K3 model and Alibaba's Qwen 3.8 Max, which were released in recent days and viewed favorably by investors and users, has turned the AI race on its head once again. Kimi K3 also was competitive with U.S. models on some benchmarks. The debate over the new models, which are open weight, allowing users to download and customize them with company data and for specific tasks, coincides with division in the Trump administration about whether to take steps to limit the use of the models in the U.S. One probable outcome of an open weight model dominant world is full AI communism, which is precisely what China proposes, rather than a market product. AI is a public good, which will ultimately be provided by the state as a kind of digital public infrastructure, Dean Ball, OpenAI's head of strategic futures, said in an X post Friday. Ball, a former Trump administration official, called such a scenario a dystopian hellscape and said he expected the Trump administration to make moves to reduce the usage of open source models. Ball later clarified that he wasn't advocating for the U.S. government to discourage Chinese AI. He also highlighted a central challenge with the AI race. Top-tier AI companies raise billions of dollars to pay for the vast computing resources needed to continue improving AI systems. If everyone uses AI systems that people largely don't pay for, there would be no way to finance continued frontier AI development. Ball, who started at the company earlier this month and focuses on policy, strategy, and OpenAI, have said his comments don't reflect the company's official positions. The company has developed its own open models, and CEO Sam Altman has previously said OpenAI's past approach of only developing closed tools was unwise. Other top AI officials have warned that open models present huge risks since developers and policymakers lack control over how they're used or modified. Anthropic chief executive Dario Amodi, for years, has warned about the risks of powerful and open AI systems, saying in a recent Bloomberg interview that having AI models with advanced cybersecurity capabilities that are free to download could be harmful. "It's a serious concern," he said in June. Usage of Chinese models, which are far cheaper than U.S. counterparts, is surging at U.S. companies, prompting some investors to question the staying power of top model makers such as Anthropic and OpenAI. The current U.S. open source model frontier is starting to catch up with China's. Last Wednesday, Thinking Machines Lab, led by former OpenAI technology chief Mira Murati, released its first AI model as open weight. NVIDIA's Nemotron 3 Ultra is starting to see traction, and Reflection AI, an NVIDIA-backed open model developer, has close ties to the Trump administration and plans to release its first model later this year. The market's faith in Anthropic and OpenAI continuing to build more capable models that push the AI frontier has been at the heart of the boom, helping to justify trillions of dollars in spending on infrastructure in the coming years. The threat that new players will vastly undercut what they can charge for advanced AI pushed down some tech and AI company stock prices last week. David Sacks, a venture capitalist and White House AI advisor, suggested that he read Ball's post as a confession to a regulatory capture strategy. Sachs and others have long seen calls for AI regulation by companies such as Anthropic as efforts to use new laws and policies to stymie competitors. The weaponization of regulatory uncertainty as a competitive tool should be completely unacceptable, Sachs said in an X post on Sunday. Security-focused administration officials in the past year have considered many measures to crack down on Chinese AI companies developing open models, people familiar with the discussion said. They have weighed adding the businesses to trade blacklists, security warnings on Chinese AI companies, and a potential executive order targeting open models, the people said, adding that disagreement within the administration has prevented any such action. That tension has also delayed implementation of a recent executive order asking companies to give the administration early access to their most powerful models up to 30 days before they're released. The CEOs of OpenAI, Anthropic, and Alphabet's DeepMind have recently signaled they support increasing government oversight of AI as models become popular, fueling some criticism that the companies are trying to stifle their competition. Alphabet is the parent company of Google. Congress restricted the use of Chinese model DeepSeek on federal and defense networks because of security and privacy concerns last year, but lawmakers and the administration have stopped short of imposing other restrictions. One challenge is that smaller model makers, including several Chinese companies, use a technique called distillation, in which they harvest the capabilities of the top U.S. tools. Officials who push for oversight of AI have worried that open models could pose cyber and biological weapons risks if they continue advancing and don't have to follow the same rules as top U.S. companies such as Anthropic and OpenAI, the people said. The new focus on the issue shows how the messy policies surrounding open models are challenging CEOs trying to cut their AI bills and policymakers who don't want the technology used to harm the U.S. And that's Chinese AI models raise alarm in U.S. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. You can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, such as the Wall Street Journal, either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. You can get that for your iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Moving on now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal, we have these headlines. CEO offers clues to PayPal's path. Judge holds up Paramount purchase of Warner. And Heineken adds battery heat to brewing tools. That first headline, CEO offers clues to PayPal's path. Enrique Lores took top job after decades at HP, where he drove its transformation. This article is by Ben Glickman and Peter Ruderier. Digital payments pioneer PayPal is in a years-long rut. Enrique Lores is tasked with saving it. The 61-year-old was named chief executive of PayPal this year after decades at HP and its predecessor company, Hewlett-Packard, where he played a role in splitting it up. Lores has since announced a turnaround plan for PayPal that includes reorganizing its business lines and cutting at least $1.5 billion in costs, moves reminiscent of the playbook he's deployed in his previous roles. Now, one of PayPal's rivals has lobbied a buyout offer. Payments company Stripe and private equity firm Advent International have made a joint takeover bid for PayPal, valued at $53 billion. The Wall Street Journal reported last week. The approach, made in recent days, represented about a 30% premium to PayPal's recent stock price. Shares jumped 17% on Wednesday on the news. The deal would unite top players in the payments world, PayPal's network of consumers and recognizable brands, and Stripe's business providing transaction processing infrastructure for merchants. Such heft would be an advantage in the payments ecosystem, which is poised to undergo further disruption from new tech like artificial intelligence and stablecoins. PayPal's peer-to-peer payment app, Venmo, may be particularly desirable. Its revenue rose 20% last year, and it boasts 67 million monthly active users. A deal would also transform one of Silicon Valley's most storied companies, whose yellow and blue button has long ruled online payments. PayPal's founders and early employees are seen as the stuff of legend among startups, with the ranks of the so-called PayPal Mafia, such as Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, going on to invest in or launch businesses that have become corporate heavyweights. Shares in PayPal, meanwhile, have been on a precipitous fall amid competition from the likes of Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Cash App. In February, PayPal announced that Loris would take over as CEO in a surprise shuffle. A profit warning accompanied the appointment, and the company's stock slid 19%. Analysts saw Loris's history helping to break up Hewlett-Packard and then managing HP as clues of what could be in store for PayPal. Intern to C-suite. Loris, a native of Spain, joined Hewlett-Packard in 1989 as an engineering intern in San Diego and then worked full-time in his home country. He rose to lead the division that made printing technology for large formats such as signs or billboards. He moved to Silicon Valley in 2008 and held roles overseeing the company's worldwide business, laptops, and customer service. In 2015, Hewlett-Packard split itself in two. HP Inc. took the printer and personal computer businesses, while Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, or HPE, would sell software, servers, and other services. Loris was in charge of simplifying the organization and reducing its cost structure before the split was finalized. The company described him as a key architect of one of the largest and most complex corporate separations in business history. Loris landed with HP and became CEO in 2019 as the company faced slowing sales and souring investor sentiment and got to work. He announced plans to cut up to 16% of the company's 55,000 employees, yielding $1 billion in cost cuts and increase its stock buybacks by billions. Loris has dealt with suitors trying to amend his turnaround plans before. In 2019, days after Loris took over as HP's chief, Xerox, backed by Carl Icahn, launched a takeover bid for HP that would later become hostile. Xerox raised pressure on HP for months until the pandemic prompted it to abandon the pursuit. Shares of HP climbed during the pandemic as it benefited from more people buying equipment to work from home. Loris joined PayPal's board in 2021 and was selected as chair in 2024. A new fixer-upper. Loris was brought in at PayPal after the company's namesake checkout button, which lets customers pay on a range of websites, posted weak growth to end 2025. Ambitious plans by PayPal's past two CEOs had also failed to materialize. In 2021, for instance, PayPal was enjoying a pandemic-induced boom in e-commerce when then-CEO Dan Schulman laid out a growth strategy. The plans included rolling out a super app that would offer payments, shopping tools, savings accounts, and stock and crypto trading. Later that year, PayPal explored a potential $40 billion-plus acquisition of Pinterest, which it dropped. The company got a reality check in 2022 as in-store shopping recovered from the pandemic. Its growth slowed and its stock fell, and PayPal abandoned its ambitious targets. Schulman stepped down in 2023, handing the reins to Intuit executive Alex Criss. Criss stumbled out of the gate, overpromising to shock the world with a suite of product announcements that failed to inspire. The company, which lost market share to rivals like Apple Pay, underwent rounds of layoffs to cut costs. Loris struck a more subtle tone. He's espoused a vision of modernizing PayPal's technology and cutting costs to reinvest in growth. He reorganized the business, creating a standalone consumer unit that houses Venmo and has argued the company can be a go-to for consumers' other financial activities. Now, Loris could be overseeing another big corporate deal. He's emphasized his focus on maximizing shareholder value and has said the company should look at optimizing our portfolio, sometimes seen as Wall Street code for selling parts of the business. PayPal hasn't responded to Stripe and Advent's offer. And that's CEO offers clues to PayPal's path. Next, we have an article by Joe Flint, Judge Holds Up Paramount Purchase of Warner. The proposed $81 billion merger of Paramount and Warner Brothers Discovery hit a significant speed bump Monday when a federal judge in California granted a temporary restraining order that prohibits the companies from closing the deal. The court said that during the pause, it would consider whether the merger should remain blocked pending the resolution of an antitrust challenge brought by a dozen states. The 14-day restraining order means Paramount will fall short on its hopes to have the deal closed before the end of the month. If the court later grants the states a preliminary injunction, the companies would be barred from closing the merger while the state's antitrust lawsuit proceeds. A hearing for a preliminary injunction has been scheduled for August the 3rd. In her ruling, U.S. District Judge Araceli Martinez Olguin said the combination of the two film studios' market share of theatrical movies has persuaded the court that it can presume the proposed merger is likely to violate antitrust laws. The ruling is a first step toward potentially granting a preliminary injunction that would essentially stop the merger from proceeding during the case. Martinez Olguin, an appointee of President Joe Biden, said if the deal were permitted to proceed during the case, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to unwind given the anticipated consolidation of operations, sharing of business-sensitive information, and potential termination or reassignment of employees. California Attorney General Rob Bonta, a Democrat, called the ruling a critical first win in our case to ensure this mega merger, never sees the light of day. He said, "We have a full tank of gas, the law on our side, and look forward to continuing to make our case." Paramount said it's confident the evidence will demonstrate that the state attorneys general antitrust arguments are without merit as their alleged markets and claims of anti-competitive effects are without any basis in modern market realities. Until now, Paramount has faced few headwinds getting its deal through regulatory agencies in the U.S. and abroad. Justice Department approved the transaction last month, saying it would improve competition across the media and entertainment ecosystem. The deal has also been cleared by several overseas regulatory bodies, including in Australia and China, but is still awaiting approval from the UK and the European Union. If the litigation extends beyond the end of September, the delay could become costly for Paramount. Under the merger agreement, Paramount agreed to pay Warner shareholders a quarterly ticking fee of 25 cents a share if the deal hasn't closed by September 30th, amounting to roughly $650 million every 3 months until the transaction closes. California and by 11 other Democrat-run states said in their suit a merger would lead to higher prices, lower quality, and less content for film and television. Not only would theaters and pay TV distributors be harmed, but so would audiences on every sofa and movie theater in the U.S., Bonta said last week. Among Paramount executives, there is unease and frustration over a potentially drawn-out closing process. A complex integration is ahead, including putting the Paramount Plus and HBO Max streaming services together and combining CNN with CBS News. And that's Judge Holds Up Paramount Purchase of Warner. Our next headline, Heineken adds battery heat to brewing tools. This is by Clara Hudson. When you aren't cracking open a cold beer, you probably aren't thinking about just how much heat breweries need to produce endless vats, bottles, and cans of the stuff at commercial scale. But Heineken does. The beverage giant is developing a new way to satisfy its demand for industrial heat to generate steam at its brewery near Lisbon, which requires clouds of heated water vapor during the beer-making process from brewing to pasteurization. The Dutch company is setting up a large heat batteries made by thermal storage startup Rondo Energy that convert wind and solar power into heat and then store it in clay bricks at up to 1500 degrees Celsius, holding the energy for days. Heineken expects the project to be fully up and running by the first half of 2028, ready to gather power from a neighboring solar plant. The beer-making recipe won't change, but the industrial process will use the heat stored in batteries to turn water into steam, which will then be used to boil the mixture of malt and water before hops are added. Then yeast is added for fermentation, where it eats away at the sugar, creating alcohol and carbon dioxide bubbles. The beer is then left to mature to bolster the flavor. The storage bricks will provide industrial heat once again as the beer is pasteurized and steam is sprayed over the bottles to kill microorganisms. While the heat batteries are a new development, they use technology from a familiar kitchen appliance. They have the same bare wire heating elements in a typical toaster, said John O'Donnell, the founder of Rondo, which is based in Alameda, California. The brick is like a 3D checkerboard, he said, explaining that it's made up of a patchwork of blocks and open chambers with small passages throughout the stack for the heat to bounce around. The brick stack has hundreds of these toaster-like heating elements throughout. The initiative will help the company decarbonize by alleviating its reliance on fossil fuels to produce industrial heat, reducing about 25% to 40% of carbon emissions from its operations at the Portugal plant, said Nicolas Clergé, Global Climate Director at Heineken. But there's another bonus, he said, because the heat storage can decouple the company from the volatility of the energy market. That becomes particularly appealing when the electric grid is stressed. Manufacturers looking to lower their carbon emissions are increasingly focused on how to reduce their heat demands. Industrial heat takes a toll, with about one-fifth of all global energy used to produce heat for industry, according to the International Energy Agency. Meanwhile, there's a growing business case for companies in Europe to electrify their industrial heat, according to a recent report from McKinsey, particularly as fossil fuel prices remain volatile. Other beverage producers may also find it appealing to use thermal energy from solar, said Yangying Zhu, whose research includes sustainable energy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. That's because they typically use temperatures under 150 degrees Celsius and don't need to take additional steps to create the much higher temperatures required in heavier industries such as steel. Adopting heat batteries in the beverage industry is a practical way to both decarbonize and reduce costs, she said. Rondo is backed by Bill Gates' Breakthrough Energy Ventures and has raised funds from Aramco and Microsoft. Rondo isn't the only company looking to reduce emissions from heat used in manufacturing. Another startup, Antora, uses carbon blocks for its battery that glow red when heated up, also like a toaster. Antora is backed by companies including BlackRock and Breakthrough. Getting the temperature just right is paramount for making beer. Heineken's breweries have a mix of temperatures from the warm and humid brew houses to the cooler fermentation areas. Heineken says trying new ways to power its beer making will help it weather potential energy ups and downs in the future. Our breweries are a big investment. They're not just there for a few years, they're there for decades and decades, Clergé said. And that's Heineken adds battery heat to brewing tools. Our author, Clara Hudson, writes for the Wall Street Journal Pro Sustainable Business. We turn to Heard on the Street for this headline, AI supply deals are no sure thing. Long-term arrangements touted by companies like SK Hynix aren't as solid as they seem. Contracts worth billions of dollars have become the commercial glue holding the artificial intelligence boom together. But investors shouldn't rely on them sticking if the boom fades. Contracts to supply computing power for AI calculations have become such a fixture of the craze that whole industries have begun reorganizing around them. AI suppliers say these arrangements give them unprecedented visibility into their future revenue, allowing them to wow investors with promises of bumper sales and profits ahead. The computer memory business may be the most extreme example. Memory suppliers and their customers have sought out longer dated deals in recent months. This is because of the explosive growth of autonomous AI agents, which are memory intensive. And that is turning what has historically been a cutthroat cyclical business where price competition is fierce into something much more stable. The world's big memory chip manufacturers, South Korea's Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix, along with U.S.-based Micron Technology, are all raking in record profits and touting a supply shortage they expect to last into 2028. An executive at SK Hynix was listed shares in New York this month to capitalize on the excitement about memory, suggested on a call with analysts in April that long-term deals could improve the market's view of the memory business as a whole. Micron has been an especially active deal maker. Its strategic customer agreements typically last 5 years and are take or pay. This means the buyer has to pony up whether they take shipment of the memory or not. Last month, Micron chief executive Sanjay Mehrotra said on an earnings call that these agreements would supply more than half of the company's revenue in the years ahead. That sounds like a boon for investors in memory companies, and they've been strong choices of late. Micron's stock has roughly tripled this year, SK Hynix has risen nearly as much, and Samsung has about doubled. But while the long-term contracts are helping drive the upswing, there's reason to wonder whether they provide any certainty in a downturn. Indeed, if demand for memory should ebb before the supply contracts expire, those will likely be renegotiated or extended. Chip suppliers don't like sending products to customers who aren't going to use them. If they do, the chips will sit on the shelf until demand returns, and at that point, customers will draw down inventories before they buy new chips, delaying revenue for the chip makers. Suppliers also don't like to force products on their customers who don't want them, especially if competitors are being more flexible. Pushing unwanted memory into the supply chain could fray long-term customer relationships. You don't have to dig too deep into tech history to find evidence suggesting that suppliers will be accommodating in a downturn. A similar shift to longer-dated contracts happened during the COVID-era chip shortage. Chip makers used them to help fund the expansion of their manufacturing capacity and decide which customers got preferential treatment. Microchip technology, which makes microcontroller chips that are critical in cars and a host of other electronic devices, launched a preferred supplier program back in 2021. When the shortage turned to a glut a few years later, the program was scrapped and the customers got exemptions. Flexibility became the watchword. Contracts were pushed out by years and customers weren't held to taking as much supply as their COVID-era commitments stipulated. The company's chief, Steve Sanghi, put it bluntly last November, "We're not forcing customers to buy anything they do not need." A similar dynamic is likely to play out if the AI boom weakens. Yet, the fortunes of the entire AI supply chain increasingly rest on contracts that have become larger and longer dated as companies jostle for AI-related business. This goes far beyond the memory market. Leading AI developers have contracts with cloud computing firms like Oracle and CoreWeave. These players, in turn, have contracts to buy AI computing equipment. The AI chip companies that supply much of that equipment have their own contracts with the likes of Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing to make the chips, and TSMC has long-term contracts to buy manufacturing equipment from companies like Netherlands-based ASML. The amounts involved are often gargantuan. Oracle, for instance, signed an enormous cloud computing deal with OpenAI last year and had $638 billion of so-called remaining performance obligations, essentially contracts that the company has yet to deliver on at the end of its last fiscal quarter. That figure, Finance Chief Hillary Maxson told analysts last month, provides exceptional visibility into our future revenue growth, all supported by long-term contractual customer commitments. Reliance on contracts has escalated significantly in the past year. Since the middle of 2025, four big AI spenders, Alphabet, Unit, Google, Microsoft, Amazon.com, and Oracle, have collectively more than doubled their revenue backlogs, adding more than $1 trillion to the combined figure. All that visibility could quickly become clouded, and the existence of big, long-term contracts would worsen any AI unwind. In its annual economic report earlier this month, the Bank for International Settlements suggested shortages across the AI supply chain could be amplifying overinvestment as firms attempt to lock in future capacity through long-dated contracts that further expose them to any disappointments in demand. In other words, lenders and investors who have extended funds to companies based on long-term contracts could be in for a shock. This article was by Asa Fitch. AI supply deals are no sure thing. You've been listening to The Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to The Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. If you'd like to listen to it at a time of your choosing, you can listen to the stream or select programs on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website. That's available at sunsounds.org. And you can always download the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store, or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store.